a little bit on the title of from national health insurance to compulsory health insurance. Compulsory was the language that was used in the 1940s to describe national health insurance reform. And let me just sort of start off to explain why the interest in President Harry Truman and his effort at compulsory health insurance. And I think it's the first thing we have to acknowledge is that he's the first president to take a real active role in sort of pushing for compulsory health insurance. And that he had made several major speeches and made it a major priority in his domestic program while he was president. What this is a part of course, is a case study approach and looking at comprehensively the Truman healthcare reform effort. I have more work to do, but my first question, or several questions that sort of guided my research, is to explore why it failed, what can we learn, and what does the past tell us about the future of national health insurance policymaking today? Just to say a little bit about Harry Truman, there's a couple of things there you want to know, says a little bit about him. He was a U.S. Senator, he was a Democrat from Missouri. He had gained some fame while he was in the Senate doing some committee hearings looking at military wastefulness, fraud, and mismanagement. He was nominated for the vice presidency in 1944, and at the time he was actually a very reluctant candidate for the vice presidency. And I believe when he was nominated, he said to FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who was president then, that, well, if Franklin Roosevelt wants to throw the election, go ahead and name me vice president. And so he comes actually from very modest means, modest background, very plain spoken, of course. But when he became president, the 33rd president on the death of Franklin Roosevelt, who died in Warm Springs, Georgia on April 12, 1945, Americans really sort of had gotten used to Franklin Roosevelt, who'd been president for about 12 years. And here now is Harry Truman. He's from the Midwest. He is not a patrician like Franklin Roosevelt. He doesn't have the presence, doesn't speak well. I've heard some of his early speeches, and he sort of has this flat monotone. He actually reads from a speech, and he doesn't look at the audience, and sort of been a real criticism in the early years when he was president. He was very, very active on the issue of compulsory health insurance. One of his first sort of major addresses to Congress was the Economic Bill of Rights on September 6, 1945. And at that time, what he said to the Congress, a little quote from that, is the right to adequate medical care and the opportunity to achieve and enjoy good health, right to adequate protection from the economic fears of sickness. This, of course, is all prior to the 1948 election. And so, again, this reemphasizes how very early he sort of was committed to compulsory health insurance. And he continues on and later in 1945, in November, where he actually had a specific message totally on compulsory health insurance. And what he says is that the health of this nation is a national concern. And in that speech, he sort of lays out the sort of five main points he was interested in, and he recommended things like constructions of hospitals and related facilities. He talked about the expansion of public health, maternal and child health services, medical education and research, prepayment of medical costs, and protection against loss of wages from sickness and disability. 1947, again, another message to Congress on what was described as the federal health program. Here he was talking about, again, a highlight, welfare and security of our nation demand that the opportunity for good health be made available to all, regardless of residence, race, or economic conditions. And again, in this speech, he reaffirmed those five points I've mentioned. Again, in 1948, in the State of the Union, as a part of it, again, he reemphasizes why we need compulsory health insurance. Quote, most people cannot pay for the care they need. Our ultimate aim must be a comprehensive insurance system to protect all our people against all our people equally against the insecurity and ill health. And of course, in his last speech, one of his last speeches before the 1948 campaign was before the National Health Assembly, again reemphasizing America's medicine, its benefits are not equally available to our people. It's interesting sort of how, you know, the more things change, the more things remain the same. These sort of issues are sort of very old. You know, we're talking, well, next year will be 60 years since the presidential election, so we still are talking about national health insurance, but here very early, Truman was talking about very relevant points that are sort of timeless. The next slide, this is that kind of interesting. And the reason why I have this slide here is because what this shows is that when Truman became president, it was the 79th Congress that was in power. The Democrats were in control of the both houses of Congress, the Senate and the House. And Truman did not have the popular support that Franklin Roosevelt had. As he was sort of growing into the position of being president, of course, you know, he was encountering major problems. Of course, the World War II had ended. There was a housing crisis. There was rapid inflation. There were major strikes. There was accusations of government mismanagement, corruption. And so during this time, President Truman was facing essentially a referendum in the 1946 congressional elections. And so what you see here in the 80th Congress is the result of that. Sort of the Congress changed hands completely from Democratic control to Republican control in pretty substantial numbers we're sort of seeing here. And some of this also reflects Truman's lack of popularity. When he first, one of the early polls in July 1945, they asked, it was a Gallup poll, they asked a sample of folks about, you know, what they think of the job performance of President Truman, and 87% approved of his performance. By October 1946, his job performance score had dropped down to 32%. And so there's a lot of unhappiness among the public, and in fact, the Democratic Party asked him not to campaign on their behalf. So he actually stayed in the White House and didn't say anything, which is kind of extraordinary for a president to do. The next line, this is the beginning of the what was sort of coming up as an issue in the 1948 presidential election. Truman had asked the Federal Security Agency, which is the precursor to what now is the Department of Health and Human Services, to develop a national health goals for the next 10 years. And so they, but in May, they had various sort of meetings. There was about 14 panels, a total of 850 individuals who, from medicine, public health, and industry, met in Washington. And this was all part of an eventual report that was going to be given to the president. I believe it was in September of 1948. But however, there were certain things that they agreed upon. They agreed upon the notion that the principle of contributory health insurance should be the basic method of financing medical care for a large majority of the American people. However, because of the sort of range of folks that were involved, there was no agreement on whether this would be a compulsory or voluntary method of health insurance. Now talking about the compulsory health insurance as a campaign theme in 1948, what's kind of interesting is that, as the preliminary research is showing, is that compulsory health insurance was really part of a larger attack that the President Truman had made on the Republican Congress. What he was accusing the Congress of course, is a do-nothing Congress. He actually called back to Congress after the Democratic Convention in 1948. And at that special session, he said, well, I'm calling back to special session because you have talked about all these sort of major problems like housing, health care, and so forth. Now it's your opportunity to actually do something. And of course, the Republicans were kind of like, you know, stumbling around, not quite sure what to do. And this sort of, the end of that session, actually the Congress didn't really produce very much, didn't really act on some of the major things that Truman identified. And so this do-nothing Congress label really stuck to the Republicans. This is something he had to carry around with them throughout the election. Also, New York Governor Tom Dewey, Republican, the presidential candidate, was kind of embarrassed. You know, there were reports of reporters asking him, you know, what he thought, and of course he didn't answer the question. Because part of it, you know, Republican Party politics are kind of timeless in a way. There was a very strong conservative element in the Republican Party, a little bit of a moderate to liberal. Thomas Dewey did not want to upset the leadership in the Congress by saying, oh, they did a terrible job. This is horrible. He didn't really respond. And so going back to, you know, later in the campaign, President Truman had a Labor Day message where he advocates for national health insurance. On September 2nd, there was that report, The Nation's Health, which was the outcome of the National Health Assembly. And then, of course, in September 14th, he met with the American Hospital Association officials from that organization to discuss compulsory health insurance. So there was some, in 1948, there was some, in his prior statements, there has been an interest in compulsory health. But as far as the campaign issue, it's kind of there, but it's not really on the forefront. It's really more attacking the Republicans on their do-nothing behavior. What's also interesting at this time, even up to this point from 1945 to 48, Truman, interestingly, did not endorse any specific piece of legislation. The Democratic members of the House and Senate sort of took up his ideas, and they wrote their legislation, they introduced it, there were some committee hearings, but really nothing happened beyond sort of these hearings. So, again, this is maybe kind of timeless. President Truman endorsed the broad themes of compulsory health insurance, but he really didn't sort of go into the specifics about what sort of things he was talking about, and also whether a piece of legislation is going to actually implement what he's arguing for. Of course, during this time, in 1948, there were various attacks on the compulsory health insurance. Just a couple of things here. Its comments inspired. AMA says the Americans would lack care. American College of Surgeons said it would lead to red tape and inefficiency. And the New York Academy of Medicine says now it's inspired by communists, which is all very interesting. And actually, well, maybe for the exception of communists inspired, some of this seems kind of timeless too. There is interestingly, at this time, the level of criticism of this idea of compulsory health insurance was not intense. It was there, but it wasn't really something that was really talked about by various sort of interest groups. And at this time, there was really no major campaign against compulsory health insurance. And the next slide, I think, will sort of talk a little about the nation's health. The nation's health, this document that was produced by the National Health Assembly, is actually a very important document, because here is sort of the first time Truman is really laying out exactly why we need compulsory health insurance. He's saying 325,000 people died needlessly who could get if they had gotten the care that they needed, they wouldn't have died. There's 4.3 million man years lost due to bad health. All this represents $27 billion lost through sickness and partial and total disability. And of course, referring back to when the Selective Service was drafting men for the military in World War II, 5 million men were ruled as unfit because of various sort of health disabilities and ailments. And so this is a key document. In that report also, they laid out an argument for prepaid health insurance. That people lack care due to high costs and low income. Voluntary insurance, they're saying in that document, is inadequate. It's not enough. It only covers a fraction of the population. And those who have the poorest coverage have the greatest need. And it was their estimate that what this would cost to implement it would represent about 3% of the annual earnings, up to $4,800 at that time. Now we get to the 1948 presidential election. What's interesting about the election was that everyone forecast that Truman was going to lose. Even Democrats were saying Truman's going to lose when the various surveys that were done. And a lot of that had to do with sort of his unpopularity as a president, his performance in office, but also there was a three-way split in the Democratic Party. Henry Wallace, who used to be was vice president with Franklin Roosevelt before he was replaced by Harry Truman, was running as a representative for the Progressive Party. Strom Thurmond was running for the interesting thing. He's no longer around, but he's still around in some ways. He was running under the State Rights Party, the Dixiecrats. He was a Democrat governor of South Carolina. And, of course, these polls, which sort of show, you know, what the polling agencies were measuring in terms of, you know, well, Dewey's going to win, Truman's going to lose. And so, and in fact, the Democratic Party platform, which was written and approved at the Democratic Convention in July, national health insurance was not even mentioned in that document. I think even the party sort of felt that this was kind of a losing issue for him. And so moving on, let's see, there's the results. Oops, the results, of course. He won the election, big surprise, and a lot of this was stemmed, of course, from his Whistle Stop campaign. And what is interesting, though, is the fact that he turned to Congress to Democratic control. The Democrats won the House and the Senate. Now you begin to see the AMA doing its campaign. They're gearing up. They're voluntary assessing doctors around the country, $25. This is Truman comes back in April 22nd, 1949. This is his message to Congress about health insurance, and this is sort of what he's laying out. The bullets below April 22nd are sort of what was actually in the legislation that was introduced at that time. And so, going on to the next slide, this is where now you begin to see things sort of changing in the interest group universe. The AMA is critical of the health proposal. They're talking about the Republicans themselves. They're actually pushing for voluntary health insurance. The Republican leader in the Congress says this plan is doomed. Now you begin to hear this whole notion about socialized medicine a lot of the time. And so what happens, it's interesting, is that shortly after his speech he made to Congress on the 22nd, Democratic chair of the subcommittee says, "I'm sorry, we're going to have to delay action. You know, that there's divided support on this committee. There are other proposals which are being introduced, and so there's divided sort of support for his proposal." And so essentially what happens is that there's just a lot of hearings being held, but nothing goes to the floor. Nothing gets voted out of the committees. And, of course, Dewey at this time says socialized medicine is the keystone of the arch of the socialist state. Possible factors, of course, looking at this interest group opposition. One of the groups that was interestingly opposed comprehensive health insurance was the state and local territorial health officers opposed comprehensive health compulsory health insurance at this time. Also, the AMA was gearing up for another campaign. They were doing another assessment of $25, their first time in their history they were assessing dues. And also, this characterization of compulsory health insurance and socialized medicine in association with communism, I think, is sort of a factor. Also, the absence of presidential leadership. Also, what's also interesting in some polling I've seen is that if you look at the public, they didn't really think of compulsory health insurance or health insurance as an issue as top priority. And this is actually consistent through 1949, which is kind of interesting. Their number one concern was the high cost of living, housing, rent control, and their third, of course, handling Russia and preventing war. So I think, you know, despite what Truman was saying, there wasn't any sort of recognized sense or belief that there was a crisis in health care, which I think sort of also was a factor that contributed to its eventual defeat. See, this is the end. By October, they abandoned the hope for reintroducing it in 1950. There were some alternatives they were thinking about, and of course, going into 1950 congressional election, the Republicans were attacking Truman's efforts and describing his fair deal, which the compulsory health insurance was a part of, as liberty versus socialism. 1950 election, a number of prominent Democrats get defeated. There's narrow party control in the Congress, so it's much harder for them, President Truman, and Democrats to get any sort of, you know, social legislation through. And so essentially we're sort of seeing the end of that for compulsory health insurance. And of course, at the end, key elements we have to ask is, you know, what is the future? I think the questions that need to be answered, you know, who controls Congress by how much is the key? President needs a significant majority of the vote in the Electoral College, coattails instead of reverse coattails, and then, of course, what will happen in 2008. The reason why I say that is because in previous Democratic landslides in 1932, Franklin Roosevelt won 57% to Hoover's 40. Lyndon Johnson won 61% to Barry Goldwater. Goldwater's 39%. But after 1932, we saw the Social Security Act was enacted in 1935. And, of course, in 1965, we saw Medicare legislation being enacted. And so one possible scenario is that if the Democrats win in a landslide to have overwhelming control of the Congress, then possibly we might see, you know, compulsory health insurance, or now what we call it, national health insurance, coming to the forefront. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Begay. Our next speaker is Dr. Ollie Fine. Dr. Fine has been a leader in the battle for social justice and change for decades. He is a physician activist. He's chair of the New York chapter of Physicians for National Health Program. He's associate dean of the Weill Cornell Medical College in New York City, and he is president-elect for Physicians for National Health Program.
I'll just call somebody up here to help me get the slides up. Thanks very much for having me. One of the things that is fascinating in this history, of course, is to realize that during Second World War, unions were forbidden from negotiating for health care benefits, right? For wages, that there was what we call wage stabilization. And the result was that they could bargain for fringe benefits, and the two essential fringe benefits they bargained for was indeed health insurance and pensions. And this, I think, leads to the phenomenon of wedding our health insurance to employment in the United States. As you probably realize, we are really the only industrialized nation that when you lose your employment, or you graduate from college and lose your parents' coverage, you end up being uninsured. And along came the IRS, the Internal Revenue Service, and said that the employer contribution to buying health insurance for employees could be tax deductible, and this truly wedded the situation. Your number of 143 million having voluntary health insurance is remarkable because today it's roughly 159 million, not so many more that have employer-based health insurance in the United States. So I'm not going to go further through this history. The question is, what are the fundamental problems facing us today? And quite clearly they are the fact that there are escalating costs. Family coverage, on average, in the United States is $12,106. Declining choice, largely because most of us are in some form of managed care insurance, which limits our choice of doctor and hospital. You know, you have to go to the particular network, or you have to pay more if you go out. Quality is highly variable. The Institute of Medicine says that we have 98,000 avoidable deaths. Again, your data was fascinating that way, where you had over 100,000 deaths that were attributed to lack of health insurance. There is, I think, a major problem in this country that we are, frankly, again, among the industrialized nations, one of the few countries that actually rely so much on private health insurance. And of course there is the lack of access, now 47 million uninsured. And if you go beyond just the Census Bureau snapshot of the last year, you find out that 82 million Americans spent the last 2 years without health insurance, at least went through a period that they had no health insurance, and that more than half of the personal bankruptcies in the United States are due to medical expenditures, and over 75% of those people had health insurance at the outset of their illness. What happened to them? Why? What happened? Copays? No. They probably became unemployed because of their illness, and when you lose your job, you lose your health insurance. So what are the major policy options that we face today? And I would classify them in these three areas, and I wanted to just dilate and explore those with you very briefly. The individually oriented approaches are ones that we see being put forward largely by the Republicans, it's true, but increasingly corporate America is joining this with what they call a defined contribution health benefit. Up until now, we've had defined benefits, right? But here, what they're proposing is that we will give each worker, each employee, a certain amount of money, $3,000, $4,000, you go out and find a health insurance policy that meets your needs. Or a health savings account, right, in which they will give you a certain amount of money that is tax exempt and put it into an account. or what they're calling consumer-directed health care. Now, you know, you can decide which health policy you want. Or President Bush's wonderful idea of tax deductions, right? This is all part of this notion of the ownership society. And what's wrong with these is looking, frankly, at who benefits. Employers benefit from a defined contribution, right? Because it's limited and predictable every year. Banks benefit from HSAs, because it's a kind of investment that they can take your money and make money with it, right? Private insurers love these high-deductible, consumer-directed choice policies because it means more people are going to buy private health insurance. And tax deductions really are only meaningful to people who have enough money, you know, where they don't pay tax, pay enough taxes so that getting a deduction makes a difference. If you're in fact middle income or less, you may not in fact be paying so many taxes. So it really benefits the wealthy. Well, what about state-based approaches? That's what everyone has been turning to, right? And these state-based approaches are frequently ones that expand Medicaid to cover more people. SCHIP is part of this on some level. There is the California plan that was a single-payer plan but vetoed by Governor Schwarzenegger. And there's the Massachusetts plan, which was passed in Massachusetts and therefore deserves a little bit more of our attention this afternoon. What was the Massachusetts health plan? What is it? It's essentially an individual mandate. That means that everybody in the state of Massachusetts must buy some form of health insurance, or they will be against the law. What the penalties are against the law, well, they will probably have somewhere close to $1,000 deducted from their taxes or any tax return, or they will be taxed $1,000. Or who knows in terms of whether they'll have to go to jail. We don't know. Right, but essentially that's what the individual mandate. It's modeled after the notion that indeed we can require people to buy auto insurance if they own an automobile, but it's a little bit crazy. You mean if I'm alive and in the state of Massachusetts, I have to buy health insurance or die? So what you have is this kind of situation. The really poor get a modest expansion of Medicaid. The near poor get subsidies to purchase private health insurance. But if you're not near poor, that means three times the level of poverty if you're an individual. That's $30,000. You're going to be mandated to purchase private health insurance. Yes, you can do it with pre-tax dollars. Great. An employer mandate, you know, essentially says that businesses with more than 10 employees must buy health insurance for their employees or pay $295. The law creates a new connector agency. Yeah, you can ask yourself the question, what would businesses prefer to do? You know, buy $12,000 worth of policy or, you know, $295. It's a meaningless employer mandate. And the new state agency that's called the Connector is supposed to design affordable private health insurance plans and help people connect with private health insurance. And in order to get the hospitals to buy into this, a rate hike was included. So I want to describe what I call the mass failure. Okay, and on one level, it's a failure for the uninsured. Why? Because there were essentially 651,000 uninsured people in Massachusetts. 28% of those do have incomes low enough to qualify for free coverage. Great. 34% get partial subsidies to buy private health insurance. 35% get no assistance with coverage. And what's happened as of, you know, the plan literally goes into effect in terms of law, only 25% had enrolled by July 1st, and those who do not enroll actually face a $1,000 fine if they don't get in before the end of the tax year. Well, it's also a failure because, frankly, it increases those people who are going to be underinsured, who have to buy what I call junk health insurance or stripped-down skinny policies. Here, for instance, is a couple in their 50s. They face a premium of $8,638 with a $2,000 deductible for each of the people involved, no prescription drug benefits, and, of course, only 2% of people who were eligible for this have actually bought coverage as of September 30th. So what we find here is that the private health insurance companies also, by the way, contribute less to the free care pool so that the safety net clinics and hospitals are finding their reimbursements closed, like Cambridge City Hospital and its network of clinics. And, frankly, it's a mass failure because all it does, frankly, is help keep the private health insurance companies in the business. It increases bureaucracy and costs. How does it do that? Essentially, we know that 19% of premium, on average, across private health insurance companies, go for, administration and profit. That means that, fundamentally, less than 81% of dollars go to pay for doctors and hospitals. The connector adds to this bill 4.5% to premiums. So now we're going to be paying close to 25% in administrative costs. If we had some folks in the state of Massachusetts do a calculation, if we went to a single payer from this multi-payer private insurance-based system, we could redirect $7.7 billion from overhead and profits to cover the uninsured and upgrade the policies for the underinsured. Massachusetts has been a failure.
Is it still in effect?
It's still in effect. In fact, what you will hear most people tell you is that we don't have enough time to tell that it's been a failure, and that's possibly true, too. Okay? But take a look at state interventions. This red line represents the number of uninsured. There was a Dukakis bill back here, and what you can see is that the number of uninsured since the Dukakis bill was passed has actually gone up. Maine, the Durajo bill here in 2003, the number of uninsured has stayed essentially the same. Minnesota Care in 1992, a little drop at the time it's passed, but it's all the same since then. The Oregon Health Plan, right? The state-based program, little decline here. We now have more uninsured in the state of Oregon. TennCare, yes, a nice drop in the uninsured in 1993, but now we're back up again to higher levels. The Washington State reform, similar, 1992, and here we are. And Vermont bubbles up and down, but we have more uninsured now than they had in 1992. Frankly, state-based health insurance reform is not going to do it. The time has come for a national health insurance program in the United States. And there are two kinds of programs that are being talked about out there now, right? One is what we hear from the Democratic Party candidates at this time, the leading ones, just essentially programs that subsidize access to private health insurance, very similar to the mandate approach in the state of Massachusetts. So that Mrs. Clinton, I believe Edwards and Obama have all come out for some form of individual mandate. The other option is to go towards a single-payer national health insurance program similar to what's embodied in H.R. 676, which is endorsed by Conyers, another presidential candidate, Kucinich, and McDermott, we now have 86 sponsors, co-sponsors in the House of Representatives for this approach. Well, what is this approach? Just very quickly, the physician's proposal, which is published in the Journal of the American Medical Association of 2003, points out that these are the essential principles that you should look for in what presidential candidates propose. When they talk about universal coverage, do they really talk about covering all residents in the United States? When they talk about comprehensive coverage, do they talk about coverage that includes doctors, hospitals, reproductive health, you know, mental health, dental health, long-term care? Are they talking about a system in which we would get rid of copays and deductibles, these very crude instruments to control demand? Well, the problem is it controls demand equally for those who are overutilizers from those who are underutilizers, so that it can be very destructive. Are they talking about that kind of proposal? Frankly, I think the only proposal that will satisfy this approach is one in which we talk about a single-payer program in which there is no ability to duplicate coverage by private health insurance. Private health insurance can cover what's not covered in the single-payer program, but not what's in the single-payer program. Is there a country in this in the world that does that, a capitalist country? It's Canada, right? They have that law. Publicly funded with low administrative costs, such as the Medicare program, where you have a 3% Medicaid administrative cost compared to that 19% that I described to you earlier. Maximum choice of provider, none of this stuff where you have to choose a health plan which chooses who you can see, which doctors and which hospitals. Medicare gives you the maximum choice of provider. And finally, this should all be delivered through a nonprofit delivery system. We're not talking about socialized medicine. In fact, the socialists would criticize us, right? Because we're not talking about, you know, hospitals being owned by the government or doctors or nurses being salaried by government. No, there would be local control. This is the proposal for single payer. Frankly, I think when you compare all the proposals that are out there, clearly single payer comes out ahead of all the others. We know what's right, frankly, and it would be a real disaster, I think, if the Democratic Party adopts this notion of a individual mandate, because what that will be is an individual mandate to buy inferior, you know, phony, you know, junk, whatever you want to call it, policies. We've got to be active as public health people calling for a single-payer national health insurance program. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Fine. This talk always prompts many questions, but we'll save them for the end. I wanted to let you know that this morning, before we went to the Capitol, we were at the National Press Club, Physicians for National Health Program, and California Nurses Association, where we met with Representative John Conyers and Michael Moore, who was there by satellite uplink, and had a very interesting and entertaining press conference promoting Senate Bill 676. So, pardon me? Oh, sorry, House Bill, yes. Our next speaker is Billy Avery. Billy Avery has been a women's reproductive health activist for over 30 years. She's the founder of the Black Women's Health Imperative and the Avery Institute for Social Change. She's a MacArthur Fellow and is now working on raising women's voices for healthcare reform. Billy.
I'm just going to put up our website so that you can contact us if you need.
Good afternoon. It is good to see the room almost full. This is great. Hope we are getting ready to wrap things up here and make some action. I'm going to talk a little bit about some thoughts about organizing. And I do that with one of my very good friends, Randy Camion, in the audience back there, who helped me organize one of the most dynamic town meetings in Gainesville, Florida, that I'll talk about in a minute. As was stated, my background, I come from the women's health movement. This got started in the late 60s and the 70s. And we came out of consciousness raising, where we came together and talked openly and honestly about our lives, about what was happening with us. We learned from each other. We learned to value our experiences. We learned to value our thoughts. We learned to value ourselves as women. And we also learned the power of what can happen when we come together to make changes around our healthcare system. And it's pretty dismaying that a lot of the young people today have no idea of where things came from. You know, they have access to their medical records. They don't exactly know how that happened. Thought it always was that way. They get treated. They're called by their name. They're not waiting to see a provider come in the room and see them all dressed in a little gown and either laying in a lithotomy position or when they're greeted. So some of the things, some of the information has gotten lost, but that is our fault because we didn't ritualistically give the history. So thank you so much for those historical presentations, because we need to know where we came from so that we can have a clear picture of where we're going. Now, some of the things that I've learned around organizing around healthcare reform, that first of all, it's a very difficult issue. It's real hard. And it also is not, you know, while it's crucial to our existence, it's not the sexiest, hottest thing out there. So you got to really put some energy into it to make it, to be creative, to make it interesting. Because after all, we compete in a whole media world here where everything goes bam, 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 bam. And so our organizing has to be that way in order to hold people's attention, because that seems to be in the place of where they are. We have brought people together around healthcare reform. We've done about 5 or 6 town meetings across the country. And one of the first things we do, and I'm telling you this so y'all can go back and do something, we're supposed to be raising up the heat before the election, right? That's why we're here. And so we need to make some noise. We need some people in the streets. And it's like Flo Kennedy, I don't know if you all remember her, and she used to tell us in the women's movement, you got to spill more than menstrual blood in order to get changes. So we're ready for some spilling to go on so that we can have some y'all health people. You know about menstrual blood, so come on. Come on. Okay. So one of the things we've done with our town meetings, we go in to a place and we organize a task force. We bring together a diverse task force, not just all white people, not just all black people, not just all straight people, but people in all of our diversity. Bring them together and talk about what we want to do in terms of educating the public. Because as quiet as it kept, most people have no idea what their insurance policies cover. They have no idea what they have. They find out when they get sick, which is like the worst time in the world to be learning about what you have. So you got to understand that we are purposely being kept in the dark, because the less we know, you know, the more they make. And so we have to become knowledgeable about what's happening. So one of the first things to do is to start organizing, get your task force organized so that you can plan to put on a very effective town meeting. It takes anywhere from 4 to 5 months you can do it. You can even do it in a shorter time depending on how hot the water is and how quickly we want to get people knowing things. We always have a dynamic speaker. We pretty much like Dr. Jocelyn Elders, because she pretty much can put it on the line and tell it like it is, and she's a draw and get people there. You don't have to use her, but I'm just giving you an example so you can see what happens. We always have a panel of diverse opinions. We always include physicians for the National Health Plan. They got great slides to show how the money is spent, who's making all the money, and all that information, which is very good. But we also, in Gainesville, we also have people there from the insurance industry, which was the first time I had anybody directly from the insurance industry. And that led to a very, very lively kind of town meeting. But they need to hear. They need to hear directly from the people. They need to hear their anger. They need to know what their issues are. And they need to understand that they have got to change. It cannot stay that way. But we have to build the groundswell of people. Randy worked with me on the Gainesville one, and she is an excellent organizer. And we were able to get co-sponsors. We had over 40 organizations co-sponsor, all the way from the League of Women Voters to the NAACP, which is pretty unheard of. We had the head of the local hospitals there, we had the mayor, we had people from the city council there, and we had folks who were walking around with buttons on saying insurance was an X through them, and there was, you know, all the booths outside and everything. So it made for a nervous kind of time. But you know what? It was a very educational time. And we have to really not be afraid to bring these intersections into play. To have these people sitting in the room talking together, I find is to be most helpful, because you get a full range of what's happening. Excuse me. We also, what came out of the Gainesville one, thank you, Mama. What came out of the Gainesville one was a group form called Healthcare is a Human Right. And this group went on to stop Alachua General Hospital, which served the black and brown people in Gainesville, Florida, and Alachua County, from closing. They found out that they had no plans for the hospital past, was it 2010 or something like that? And they picked it. They even went in the hospital and put the flyers up in the hospital of trying to stop the hospital from closing. And so it was really a very bold action. But I'm just saying, people have to start feeling this. People have to start knowing that it's real, and people have to understand how close this whole thing is of collapsing. And it gets more and more expensive every year, and we see those numbers go up. You know, they're 41, 42, 47, whatever. And that probably ain't even the truth. It's probably even higher than what we actually see, you know. And a lot of people die because they can't get the care that they need. Just think how awful it is if you need to have a kidney transplant and you know they can do it, and you can't raise enough money at a bake sale to do it, and you can't have it. It's unbelievable. So we feel it's very important to bring people together to organize against this kind of thing. I also found that it's necessary to provide a glossary for people of what all these terms are. Because we get waylaid by all of the words and what they mean, and people don't understand and they don't know them. Also, make them know about all of the bills that's up so that they can know what they can vote for, how they need to vote, and who's doing what. One of the first town meetings I did in Provincetown, Massachusetts, we had Mike Dukakis come and explain what every single presidential candidate's health plan was. Every single one, so that people then had a way of knowing what's happening. And it's real important to stand flat on your feet and talk in plain language, because people need to understand it. You know, do it at what to say the seventh grade level, whatever. But this stuff is complicated, and so you need to make it clear so that people really understand what's going on. One of the concepts that we propose is one of the mottos of the Physicians for the National Health Program, and ours too, is healthcare is a human right. And that's something, you know, the Roosevelt started out the whole human rights thing, and he did the whole whole revolution he started is called the unfinished revolution, and we need to finish it. I think this has been a long, long time coming that this hasn't happened. But know that we're up against some very tough forces who got a lot of money. You know, the pharmaceutical companies got a lot of money, insurance companies, those are very big industries. And as one guy told me a couple of weeks ago, if we went with that single payer thing, that means that the insurance companies would collapse, and do you know what that would do to our economy? that it would just rip the economy apart. I said, well, look at all the people who would have health care. Look like that should balance it out on the other side. But he, you know, but that's how the thinking is. But that's what the thinking is. And these are the questions that have to be answered for people so that they can engage and get mobilized. We also want health care that puts people at the center and not the money. I get so tired of the minute you start talking about health care for everybody, everybody wants to talk about, how much it costs. Well, we don't want to know how much it costs. We want to talk about everybody being covered because the United States spends twice more than any other country on health care. And where is all that going? We don't use up that much every single year, not everybody, but who's getting that money? Also, we need to insist on a quality of care. We need to demand equal access for everyone. And the services need to be culturally relevant. And that is all a part of it. And well, I don't need to tell y'all to look at Sicko. It stayed in the theater about 12 minutes. And so it comes out on DVD next week. Seems as if they got some copies already. It came out today. So be sure and see that. And start working on it. What we're doing is raising women's voices. We are bringing women together. Doesn't mean that men can't come together. Y'all just, where I say women, you put men in, okay, men? Come together and organize and get your perspectives on what needs to happen. We noticed that comprehensive, the people who are organizing around health care reform are not including abortion and other reproductive health services. They want to leave it out. They say to the women, y'all just be quiet right now. Let us get this thing through with all of the Catholics and all of the people. Let's don't talk about it, and then we'll ease you in later. Well, we don't want to be eased in later. We want to be right up at the table, right in front. We don't want to be eased in later. There's no need of waiting for that. So what I say to you is, get busy, please. Go home and do something. You all are very bright, wonderful, creative people. We can do this. We can do this. We need the political will. And don't listen when they say Americans are happy with their health care. People are what people are happy with. You went to the doctor. You got cured with whatever you had. You're glad about that. But what people are unhappy about is how our services are delivered. We measure our healthcare system from the wrong end of the stick. We measure it from the thing for every device we have, everything that we have up here that's medical. We should be measured on how do you get it to the people. Because what is the need of having it if the people can't get it? I say get active, go home, raise sand, raise hell, do whatever you can, take to the streets, and remember, if you're not at the table, you're probably on the menu. Thank you.
Thank you, Billy. That is a line to remember. Thank you so much. Our next speaker, Dr. Martha Livingston, is an associate professor of health and society at the State University of New York College at Old Westbury. She is vice chair of the board of directors of the New York Metro chapter of Physicians for National Health Program. She's a member of the editorial board of the Journal of Public Health Policy. She's spoken widely on the topic of healthcare reform, and Dr. Livingston lived and studied for several years in the province of Saskatchewan, the cradle of Medicare. Her talk is Sicko Politics, Where Do We Go From Here?
Canadian Medicare.
Okay, I don't like have half a hard job now following Billy. I'll do my best. First, I want to announce on behalf of Billy and the group, which I'm a proud member of as well, Raising Women's Voices for the Healthcare We Need, that we will be having a conference at Simmons College in Boston next April 17th and 18th. So do come. Okay, and then can I start my... Yeah. What we want to do is actually the first thing you can do about national health care after we leave this session is you can go to the P. Ellen Parsons Memorial Session, which is in 158A at 2:30, and Congressman John Conyers will be there. So you can get to thank him for the courage that he's shown and the determination to get the health care we need. Okay, so I get the easy job, not only following Billy, but following all the folks who have told us how bad it is. And my job is simply, actually building on what Billy has told us, simply to tell us how to get there from here. Obviously an easy thing. If it were that easy, we'd have had health care a long time since. Okay, so one way not to get to national health care is what Julie Gerberding told us in the opening plenary session. She said, and I quote, because I was steaming so hard that I had to write down these words or I was going to explode, that American businesses cannot afford to maintain benefits for their employees because of preventable chronic diseases. That's right, it's those pesky sick people driving up the cost of health care. The American people know. And Billy is right on this. When we keep hearing that people are so happy with their health care, actually study after study after study in the last few years has shown that we are not happy about this whole mess that we're in. We're extremely unhappy. Commonwealth just came out with yet another study last week on this theme. And Dr. Fine also gave us some information about that. Here's another recent study in the state of New York. This was done by Community Service Society. 84% of poor people, 89% of near poor people, and 81% of high income people said affordable health insurance for all should be a high priority for the federal government. And yet we get told it's not politically possible. How do we make what we want politically possible? By doing it, by demanding it, not letting our candidates get away with plans that are giveaways to the for-profit insurance companies, to the privateers. 15 years ago, Bill Clinton said his plan was going to give the privateers one more chance, and if that didn't work, then it would be time for single payer. Yes, he did. He said that 15 years ago. Well, his plan was sunk. We wound up giving away a fortune in lives, health, and wealth to the HMOs, and here we are worse off than ever. Dr. Begay, I'm such an old friend. We've known each other for at least half an hour. told us that we've been fighting for health care since Harry Truman's time. Actually, not so. We've been fighting for national health care since 1904. The late, great Dr. Milton Terris said at a forum at APHA in 1998 that national health care in the United States was a drama in too many acts. What will it take to get this change? It'll take some political courage. Remember political courage? Remember Greensboro, North Carolina in 1960? I do. Four college kids sat down at a Woolworth's lunch counter and asked to be served a cup of coffee. Everybody told them they were crazy. They and their classmates went to jail. Lots of African American kids who joined the civil rights protests in their towns got thrown out of school. Some people lost jobs. Sharecroppers were thrown out of their homes on the white man's property. People were beaten. Some were killed. You know some of their names. That's political courage. In PNHP New York Metro, we had a demonstration for single-payer national health care with ACT UP last March. And 27 people, including 8 PNHP members, including doctors, along with patients, got arrested. It was much more polite, of course, than the southern jails of the 1960s. But here's the good news. You don't have to go to jail. But could we please, please stop giving up the fight before we've even engaged it? Could we please recognize that if single payer is what we want, we shouldn't, as George Lakoff and Barbara Ehrenreich would say, surrender in advance? Let's face it, single payer, I'm so tired of hearing this, is the ultimate goal. Single payer is not the ultimate goal. Healthcare justice is the ultimate goal. Single payer is actually, think about it, a modest, incremental reform in how we pay the bill for privately delivered healthcare. Dr. Fine is right. There are some folks who never joined PNHP because it was too far to the right for them, because they really did want socialized medicine. Oh, my gosh. What's healthcare justice? Healthcare justice is a healthy society where all have lives of dignity and purpose, part of which means unfettered access to healthcare that treats us with respect and caring, healthcare that includes alternative to a drug company-driven model of care, that includes midwives for women in childbirth, alternative modalities when appropriate. Okay, Miss Smarty Pants, how do we get there? What can I do? All you've proposed is getting arrested. Okay, here's some things we can all do. H.R. 676, the Conyers bill. You've heard that number. Keep thinking about that number. Is your congressperson on the bill? There's 435 of them out there. Only 86 are on the bill. Chances are no. If they're on the bill, thank them very much and tell them to say they're on the bill and tell them to talk about single... They probably don't know what single-payer health care is. They probably just signed because John Conyers is very persuasive. Educate them. I've had to do that over the years with my congressperson. Get them active on this issue. If they're not on the bill, annoy them mercilessly. You know, if 10 people a day call, it annoys their office staff enough so that they want to do something to get this constant irritant out of the way. Encourage them to become more active. Do you hear them talking? Email them, call them, visit them. This is not super hard. It may be unpleasant sometimes, depending on who your congressperson is. Locally, towns and counties are endorsing 676 and having hearings. See if there's a movement afoot where you live and participate in it. Are you in a union? Are you one of the lucky 11% of Americans in a union? We got our union to endorse 676, and now we're conducting workshops throughout the state in our union locals to talk about H.R. 676. So it's not simply something on paper. It's something that our members can learn about and really become involved in. Nationwide, over 340 unions, locals, central labor councils, and state AFL federations have signed on to 676. Get educated. People lie to you all the time about single payer. Giuliani just did last week on the question of survival rates from prostate cancer in the U.S. and the U.K. Did you see Paul Krugman's wonderful column last Friday's New York Times where he says not only was Giuliani lying, by the way, he got his so-called data from some right-wing think tank, but what Krugman further said was this isn't simply that he's wrong. This is a character issue, and we should be the people talking about character issues. Okay? You don't understand the issues? Go to pnhp.org. We have an FAQ section on there. Anything you ever wanted to know, you can find it out. But the fact of the matter is that this issue is not hard. This is about health care justice. We're paying more. We're getting less. People are dying. It's a justice issue. Don't let anybody tell you this is too hard for you to understand, you starry-eyed liberal. This is a justice issue, and we can do this. Get speakers into your agency where you work for grand rounds, into your senior center, your house of worship, your library, your community center. We've got speakers. You can become one, but in the meantime, you can get us to send speakers. We're delighted to do that. Bird dog the candidates. That's one of our strategies this year, and that is that we go to you could go by yourself. You could go with two or three friends. You're in a room of a couple hundred people. Excuse me, Congressman, or excuse me, Senator. You're running for president on this, and you want to embed the answer into the question on this plan that's really a giveaway to the insurance companies. We know it's expensive. It's not going to work. How about a single payer system which would include all of us and cost less and so forth? Why aren't you proposing that? That's really what we need. That's what you can do without having large numbers in the room. Have a sicko house party. The DVD came out today. Get yourself a DVD. Invite a bunch of friends over. Make popcorn. Maybe even a few six packs. I hope Atod isn't in the room. And then have a conversation about what you can do about this in your community. Okay? Remember, single payer is not the ultimate goal. Okay, I used to say, actually, during the time of the Clinton debacle in the early 90s, that really the thing that some of us ought to have done would have been to chain ourselves to the White House fence and demand socialized medicine, because then single payer would have been seen as the modest, less radical proposal that it really is, quite frankly. Okay, so look, we know this stuff isn't easy. We know that if we had had the power to do this, we'd have done it already. We do have the power. If we get together, stop being divided and conquered by the lies of the very well-paid enemy. Okay, we need two things. We need the power. We've got the power if we really but use it. The thing that we're really lacking so far is imagination. We need to imagine that we could have a healthcare system that actually gives healthcare to people. What a concept. Here's how I want to close. I want to close by reading into this record the name of Omar Rivera. Nobody heard of him in this room, right? He was a 12-year-old boy who died last month in Brooklyn, New York, where I'm from. And he died because of our system. I always want to put a human face on this problem. You know, when you say this many and that many people died, Omar died last month. He had some boils on his rear. His mom, that's a clear sign of MRSA. His mom took him to one of those little doc-in-the-box. They gave him amoxicillin and ibuprofen and sent him home. Amoxicillin, I mean, I'm not an MD. I knew that was wrong the minute I read that. Okay, 2 days later, he's worse. He goes to an ER where they gave him, they gave him Benadryl because they thought that he was having an allergic reaction to to ibuprofen, and he was dead 12 hours later. If he had had a medical home, if he had had a primary care doctor who knew him and cared for him, he would be alive today, and it is an outrage that he died, and it's just wrong, and I'm frankly sick and tired of seeing our people die because we don't have national health care. Let's do this. We can do this. If Billy and I can get up here and tell you to do this, and Michael and Ollie, let's do it. Let's just not surrender in advance. Let's demand the health care that we all need. Thanks very much.
As always, Martha inspires us. Questions? Yeah, let's take some questions. Go ahead.
Thank you all for this great panel. It seems to pose a little bit of a dilemma for those of us who might like to see a Democratic president in the White House. As you pointed out, the three leading Democratic candidates are all in favor of something other than what you've been advocating, the single-payer national health care system. Is there any way that the activism that you're encouraging us to engage in can get them to change their positions on this?
Okay, so I have to repeat the question because we're being filmed, that the three Democratic candidates aren't supporting single payer, and what can we do about that, given that some of us want to support Democratic candidates?
Go ahead. Ollie and Michael, why don't you both take
that? That's true, but I'm not prepared simply to be at a meeting and smile prettily when any of the so-called leading, I hate that. They've already told us what our possibilities are. Okay, that's also surrender in advance, but not really. That's the mainstream media telling us that we should have surrendered already in advance. My candidate, you know, who's going to get my vote in the primary, is a single-payer supporter. That's Dennis Kucinich. I suspect he probably won't get the nomination. I don't know. Yeah, call me wacky. If it comes to that, when it comes to that, then that doesn't mean we're not going to, you know, hold our nose and vote for the lesser of two evils. But, you know, I hate that politics. I just hate it. What I will personally do is not necessarily attack people, but question them very pointedly, and as I say, embed my answer in the question. So I think that's what we have to do.
And in addition to that, I think what we can do is work again perhaps on our congressional and Senate elections. Because if in fact there are people in Congress that push this, I suspect that a Democratic presidential person will in fact move more in this direction. So it's not a personal attack on them, it's much more an attempt to really say what is the policy solution here that will really work for the American people. I think we have it, and I think they know we have it, and will come in this direction if the people tell them that they really have to move in that direction.
I think one of the other things that we talked about in the PNHP meeting that we had on Saturday was that politicians are opportunistic. So we can always persuade them once they're in if it's what we all want. Jonathan. Right. I'm not going to try and summarize that for the tape, except for the first sentence, which was what, Jonathan, the very first thing?
When we build the parade, the politicians will run to the front of it.
When we build the parade, the politicians will run to the front of it. Yes, go ahead. Take that on. Ollie, why don't you reinterpret the question when you answer it?
Well, just first, the Herndon Alliance polling. the difficulty in all of the polling data is, are they asking the right question? You know, when we go ahead and look, for instance, at a poll like this, right, would you prefer the current system or universal health insurance like Medicare run by government, that you know, really anathema word, financed by taxpayers, the implication being increased taxes, 62% of Americans say that's what they want. Okay, so I'm not that confident in the Herndon analyses, frankly, and their polling. In terms of the Wyden bill, which is essentially a bill that would encourage the states to experiment with potentially a single-payer approach, certainly that's a great idea. That's fine. I am a little bit skeptical, frankly, that we will be able to control private health insurance adequately in this country, that they will not be able, for instance, to find ways to exclude people with pre-existing conditions. You know the way they do it now in Medicare Advantage, that wonderful way? They say a free health club membership. That's what they're going to give you if you join Medicare Advantage. Well, who wants a free health club membership? Somebody with congestive heart failure who can't walk upstairs? You know, somebody with crippling arthritis? The sick are excluded by this form of advertising, right? The private health insurance industry is going to continue to try to recruit the healthy and avoid the sick. That's the way they make their money, okay? And frankly, that's not going to work. They're going to undermine. They will fight as hard against regulation, frankly, as they will against single payer. So if we're going to conduct the fight, let's go for what we know works and not go for halfway solutions. You know, I think that's what's out on the table, frankly, now, and that's the way we need to go.
I'm going to say to Ollie that they didn't ask for the middle of the bus. You know, they asked for the front of the bus. And I think that's what we're doing. Other questions?
This is meant to be a supportive question.
A what?
A supportive question. Okay. I support single payer. But many DC jobs where I come from in Philadelphia are women holding jobs working for the insurance companies. And I'd like to know if anybody has any experience in getting, and I'm not just asking for the I'm asking, so really, how do you talk to people about supporting something that ultimately will put them
out? Right. So the question is, if we come up with single payer and we put the insurance companies out of business, where will all those people work?
Right. Wonderful question, right? You know, look. Yeah, right. You see this slide, it's really great. The green bar here is the number of physicians in the country, and the blue is the number of administrators, right? Look at that increase, right, since the 1990s. Yes, we've got to find, you know, meaningful work for these folks. And the way you talk to them is saying, you know, how much do you really like to push papers and deny claims? Look at the sicko film and see the kind of angst and worry that goes through people who do this work. We have a shortage of nurses in this country now. Everybody acknowledges that. We have a shortage of many healthcare technicians in the country. We have, frankly, a shortage of doctors. These folks should be part of a job retraining program that would give them meaningful work in the healthcare system. That's what we're about.
Yes.
My name is David Danielson. I was one of the minor authors on the physician's paper back in 2003. I'm just wondering if it isn't time for a new version, a new publication, perhaps in the New England Journal, of an updated physician's plan for national health care that could answer some of these very genuine concerns over state, federal, and transitions, and quality assurance, and so on. I wonder if that's in the works. Mm-hmm.
So the question is whether it's time to update the proposal and put it into New England Journal or some other journal like that.
We'd love to do it.
Yeah, we would love to do it if they would publish it. Yeah, I think that's a great idea.
Thank you.
One at the back?
Yeah.
Do we need to stop? No, do we need to... we're taking the one at the back there. So is the question, how do you explain the cost issues? Okay.
Well, again, very quickly, here is a calculation that's been put together by the Lewin Group, which is not a, far-out group, and it shows you kind of where, in fact, things occur. Yes, there will be some increased expenditures. Covering the uninsured and the poor are going to cost more. Their estimate was roughly 6.4%. If we eliminate the co-pays and deductibles that I talked about, that's going to cost something as well, 5.1%. But there are the potentials for real savings. Bulk purchasing of drugs and equipment, we could save 2.8% on costs. Reduced hospital administrative costs, you realize that the number of administrators sending out bills at Toronto General is 3 compared to over 300 at the Massachusetts General Hospital. Reduced physician office costs. I would be able to reduce my staff again probably by 1 or 2 people if I went to a single payer program. Reduced insurance costs that we just talked about, that 19% average, which can go up, by the way, to 30% in Aetna, as it did a few years ago, we would reduce those administrative costs. And if we had more of a primary care emphasis and some reduced fraud in a single-payer program, which people project there would be, we would actually come out with a system that cost overall less than we presently have. How would it be paid for? Yes, what will happen is that those monies that are in fact going into premium costs by businesses would go, frankly, to a Medicare program, to a government-based program. Would we continue to use the, Medicare is financed by a variety of ways. Part of it is in a payroll tax. Part of it comes out of general tax revenues. I would argue that we should continue that mix of payment, not increase payroll taxes by very much, and look for the revenue that comes out of general tax revenue, which comes heavily out of corporate taxes as well as taxes on the wealthy. So there are many, many ways to describe this, and I think if people look at the calculus of what they're presently paying, they're going to come out ahead under a single-payer program.
And you're not paying all those copays and deductibles that we pay in this country that exceed that.
Yeah. Look at this slide. This is what he's saying to you, okay? On a per capita basis in the United States, we are paying roughly $6,100 for each of you for health care today. About $3,643 per capita is what is in our present government-sponsored health insurance. Okay? That is more than the public and private per capita expenditures in each of these other countries, as you can see, Canada, France, Germany, Sweden, the UK. Yes, these are numbers that come from a few years ago, but they have been updated. I just don't have that updated slide with me today. But indeed, this ratio still holds. Now, that $3,643 includes such things as the tax, relief that a corporation gets, the tax deduction they get for buying health insurance for private, for their employees. And it also includes the amount of money that you pay for the mayor and the garbage collector's health insurance, even though they buy it in the private market. So we are spending, frankly, enough money in this country to have universal coverage. The problem is we're just not getting it.
I'm afraid we're going to have to end. I think they're going to need the room pretty soon. So if you want to stay and ask questions, we're here. We'll stay behind to answer the last remaining questions. Thanks so much for attending our session. We appreciate it.